The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is David Benjamin. David is the co-founder of Syntegrity and the chief architect behind the Complexity Formula, which helps leaders and their teams get to discussions and actions in days, no matter the industry, type of challenge, or nature of the organization. David is a trusted advisor to Fortune 500 companies and government leaders on how to organize for complexity and find traction in the face of the intractable. He frequently speaks on a wide range of topics related to complexity, effective and efficient problem solving, and human dynamics in systems. He has a new book that he has co-authored with David Komolos. Did I say that right? David Komolos?
Yes.
Oh, great. It's called Cracking Complexity, the Breakthrough Formula for Solving Just About Anything Fast. David Benjamin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. So, I've been looking forward to this conversation.
Good. Well, I want to figure that out because one of my favorite things about hosting this podcast is when I'm introduced to individuals and ideas that I previously had zero experience with. But it turns out that they're completely analogous and synchronistic to the kind of work that happens at Second City Works, where we use improvisation to improve performance. Since you're Toronto-based, I'm assuming you have at least a passing knowledge of Second City, but I'm curious if you have any inkling as to how co-centric the Venn diagram of our mutual worlds appear to be.
Yes, I read the book.
Okay.
As I was reading it, I wrote down to myself that what we do is formulaic improvisation and co-creation.
Yep.
And what I found really interesting is how we reached so many of the same conclusions, but we came from a business angle, and clearly you came from a creative angle.
Yeah.
And
so many connections.
The diagram is remarkable.
Yeah. I wrote down here a quote from the book that says, groups don't gel in one step, which is essentially why yes and is a concept that we think is important.
Right.
So
I took all sorts of notes down as I was reading the book about ensembles and, certainly we have yes and baked into what we do.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera. So I'm excited to talk about those things.
Me too. So let's start, though, the conversation about where we're coming from, because one of the reasons this book is so important is because it acknowledges in a really powerful way how so many of our solution systems are built upon the premises of a world that doesn't really exist anymore. And you write of this previous world, quote, consumers bought things in local stores. Digital was a term that referred to clocks that were easier to read. Amazon was a river. Apple was a fruit. And Google wasn't even a word. The world is different now in many, many different ways.
Yes. Specifically, as we talk about the things that are covered in the book, what's really significantly changed is the pace and nature of complex challenges. And I can define that for the listeners in a moment. But also the way that leaders are going about trying to solve those big challenges. And what used to work just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. So let's talk about complexity. You have a quote in the book that says, quote, what makes a system complex is not the presence of many agents, but the fact that these agents adapt to and interact with one another in a way that creates unpredictable consequences. And to me, a very dumbed down version of this is the idea of like both things can be true. There's multiple things going on at once.
That's right. And really, it's not the domain of the scientific. Mm-hmm. There isn't sort of a mechanistic way to figure anything out. It really is where creativity has to live and breathe if you're going to get past your complex problems.
Yeah. And this is also responding to this idea that the world is decentralized now. So you can't respond in hierarchy, which another way you express it is the sort of linear thinking is you know, not a thing that works in these sort of complex times.
That's right. Hierarchies obviously still exist. And certainly when you get an ensemble together and you've got a CEO together with people further down the hierarchical chain, it certainly is an important dynamic still. But the leaders that are applying the formula are really trying to set that aside, at least during the course of the work of figuring things out, so that they can engage as equals with everybody who makes up their high variety group that has been brought together to figure things out.
I enjoyed in this part of the book where you say complexity demands a tortoise and hare hybrid approach. So everyone knows the tortoise or the hare. How and why do we do both?
Well, there's a chestnut I'm sure you've encountered, I'm sure everybody's encountered, which is you have to go slow to go fast. And that really is an axiom that we all grew up with, that slow and steady wins the race. And, you know, if you rush into answers, if you rush to action, you're going to make mistakes. You're going to end up having to repeat what you've done, and it'll end up taking you more time. And a lot of that is still true. We still have to take our time to figure things out. We still have to take our time to be creative. We can't just jump to action. But the difference today, as we say in the book, is you have to go fast at going slow to go fast. So yeah. The tortoise needs to be much faster than the tortoise ever has been before.
Mm-hmm. There's 2 points in the book that really brought me thinking about Danny Kahneman's work, and this was one of them, right? So Kahneman talks about a system one and a system two brain, the one that is knows you're a man immediately, and you're from Toronto. I pick up on this stuff right away, and the slow part of the brain, which has to figure out what else is going on. And one thing that I've sort of realized with improvisation is, when you're improvising, you're constantly switching between your system one and your system two, because you have to listen to the person with such, you know, intensity to understand the script they're making in front of you. You don't have time to pre-plan. But then when it comes to you, you shift right into this, you know, incredibly, you know, fast part of your brain to respond. And I think that what you talk a lot about in this book is this mindset that can acknowledge complexity, but at the same time see that there's an opportunity.
Right. If you're taking the approach that is encompassed by the formula, you have to start by sort of letting go of your usual way of approaching these things. And if you're a leader, or when you are a leader, that means letting go of a lot of the control that traditionally was expected of you, or maybe you were able to exercise effectively 10 or 20 years ago. You have to turn things over to the group, and really, again, just this level of vulnerability and spontaneity, and letting things come, and not believing that you have all the answers. It really is the first step in the formula, because people shouldn't even bother going any further than that if they're not willing to do that or able.
I'm curious, how hard is that? One of the hardest steps you find, that sort of, you know, ceding the need to be right?
Yeah, and it plays out initially as we were sort of doing our early work with the formula, as we were finding leaders who were willing and able to take it on. It wasn't easy to find people. They really were used to a certain way of doing things, and it was a bit of a leap to say, hey, I'm gonna go without a script. I'm gonna engage people in ways I haven't done before. I'm gonna open up the kimono and engage and involve people I wouldn't normally involve. So really, they had to sort of let that go. And then, even having let that go, when we actually bring people together to figure things out, there's another level of letting things go.
Yeah.
Where you have to sit and say, I don't know, and I don't know the answer to that, and what do you think? And again, it's not easy for people to just take that on.
You, having read the Yes And book, you know that we talk a lot about the diversity of ensembles. So I loved this chapter. I posted this on LinkedIn when I read it the other day from the book. Quote, in the complicated domain, knowledge is power. In the complex domain, a fully tapped diversity of talent is power. So we have this POV coming from the stages, but I want you to say why you think diversity inside groups in complex, dealing with complex issues is the thing you need.
So complexity, by definition, has a lot of moving and interconnected parts. And the first thing, again, as you're acknowledging that you're dealing with something like that, you have to recognize that any small group of people, no matter how smart, no matter how senior, no matter how experienced, just doesn't see everything. There are people in an organization or a system that sense what's going on and absorb the implications, and there's others who think things through and still others who decide. And those are all important perspectives. And finally, as well, the actors who will do whatever has to be done to enact whatever solution is found. So when you sort of take that range of people, you've already got a high variety. But even then, you can fall into the trap of only involving the usual suspects, the people who are easy to get, or the people who are optimists, or the people who, usually get involved in these things. So part of the challenge for leaders is to really think even broader with respect to variety. Who else would really shake things up for us? Who's going to challenge? Who's going to ask the dumb questions? Who's going to think the new thoughts? Because often we're dealing with a variety of people within one organization who all grew up there and who really don't know many other realities.
Yeah, and this concept is so prevalent in all of academia right now and talking about this work, and with the various CEOs who are writing books. I'm actually reading a book for a future podcast taping with Horst Schultz, who is the co-founder of the modern version of the Ritz-Carlton. And he has this really cool section where he talks about they couldn't get their delivery times for room service down. It was supposed to be within 30 minutes. It never was. They would always be late, and people were getting upset about it. And the usual way to solve these problems wasn't working. It wasn't getting fixed. And literally, they had to stick someone in the elevator for 24 hours to figure out what was happening. And what they discovered was that when they needed to change the bed sheets, the guy who would deliver the linens would block the elevator to hand out the linens to the maids for, 20 minutes or so at each floor. And then Schultz talks about this. He's like, and the reason he was doing that was because they only had two sets of sheets, because they cut – it was Schultz himself who said they had to cut costs when they opened, so they just stayed with that. So it ended up being his fault, but they had to find that out by – right? I mean, so you really do have to go from like – who's minding the store? Who's answering the phones? Who's washing the dishes? But also, who's outside your organization that might give you, a perspective?
That's right. And often it's your partners, the ones that are working with you in-house, the ones who are with you in the field. And again, it's got to be the partners who are willing to tell you how things are, not just protecting their next contract with you. But they are a wealth of knowledge, as are customers. And as we've found over the years, as leaders have found, sometimes it's somebody from a completely outside situation, a parallel industry with a similar challenge or even further afield than that, who just comes in and is the dumb person who's asking the smart questions.
Yeah. Here, this phrase I'm going to use over and over again. You talk about, quote, the myth of talent scarcity. Talk to us about why people think there's talent scarcity and also why it's a myth.
Well, again, people are busy. And so when you ask for their time, they don't easily make it available. And that is especially true of the people who are most obviously the ones who might have answers to things, the ones who are most senior, the ones who are most respected, ones who are most influential. So first of all, there's that notion that they're scarce or their time is scarce. But even beyond that, most leaders seem to believe that there are not a lot of people inside their organization who are capable of participating in strategy, who are capable of being innovative, who are capable of being creative. And that's because they're not usually deployed that way. So in their day job, they're just not asked to get involved in those things. So the problem isn't that they don't exist. The problem is that they haven't been tapped into. And it's not just the people in the organization. It's in and around. So we talk about this myth that we need to outsource our thinking to other people because they're smarter than us. They have a broader set of experiences, whether that's traditional consultants or other outside experts. We aren't capable in-house to figure this stuff out on our own. So that's the myth. the reality is that the talent is everywhere, especially today, and people are so well informed and so eager and interested in getting involved in figuring things out that they need to live with. It's just a matter of knowing how to engage them appropriately.
Yeah, I was speaking to a group for an innovation conference, and someone was asking me what's the biggest trap that I encountered in business, and I said success, because I know from even my own experience that with a great deal of success, you start to believe your own work, and what you're really doing is just repeating the thing that worked for you at a different time in a different context, and you can only get away with that for so long.
Right.
Yeah.
So when you've got experts on particular kinds of challenges, if you dig deep at what their expertise is, you'll see that it's largely executing a well-understood checklist with maybe some complicated steps that are mechanical in nature, and they have specific domain expertise to implement those steps. But that's very different from creating new solutions. And if you try to engage experts who are great at installing software systems in your organization, if you try to get them to figure out your growth strategy, because they're good at solving things, right? Let's go to them again. You'll quickly realize that they're even more confounded than you are.
Right.
And the approach that has traditionally worked in configuring known solutions is to just interview a whole bunch of people and figure things out by getting their input and then applying your big brain to figure it out for them. And that's what's led to so much failure to execute on what might be great strategies, but end up gathering dust because nobody knows what to do with them.
And one of the other reasons people fail in this domain is because they are often asking the wrong question, right?
Mm-hmm.
So unpack for us this idea around how you get to asking the right question.
It's surprisingly difficult to figure out the question you're trying to ask. We actually spend, with leaders who are applying the formula, we encourage them to spend a lot of time thinking about it, and then we spend a lot of time with them poking and prodding and trying to help them figure out what's right. So you need to build in a goal statement, and people will usually, I'm giving you an example, people will usually vastly underestimate what they should be setting as their goal statement. Because if you give people a reachable goal that they're trying to figure out, and again, pack this into a question, they will attain the goal. And sometimes that doesn't mean anything new needs to be created.
Yeah.
We also, as you're building a question, suggest that leaders think hard about how to make the question interesting and compelling and maybe even a little vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So how do we grow despite ourselves, for example, is an interesting way to spice up a question. By baking in the acknowledgement that we're not that good at this.
Yeah, and I really thought you phrased this very interestingly when you talk about stretch goals. So what we know, at least from the studies I've read, is that it's important to give your people space to dream big, some big audacious goals to go after, but it's also got to be okay if they can't get there. And I want to read this quote. It's a little long, but it's really smart. You say, the danger is giving stretch goals without the freedom to explore what it would take to achieve them. To ask a group to come up with 2x incremental growth while telling them not to add a budget or resources, that's just a turnoff. If there are real constraints that can't be removed, make sure the stretch goal is written within reach with creative thinking. So that's a thing that happens, right? We need you to improve X times 10. Oh, but there is no budget for any more people or any research and development or new product development. And that's kind of the worst of all worlds.
Right. And having read your book, I would rephrase that as don't give people a yes and task that is loaded with no but from the beginning.
Thank you. There you go. Nice way to turn it around. I love it. All right. I mentioned Kahneman earlier, and I this is a too long quote, but I am going to read it anyway because your chapter 8 is called Eliminate the Noise. And I love that. And I don't know if you know this, that Kahneman The book he's working on and has been working on the last few years is all around this idea around noise. And he wrote a piece in the Harvard Business Review, and I want to throw it out at you because I think it connects to what you're talking about. So he says, when people consider errors in judgment and decision making, they most likely think of social biases like the stereotyping of minorities or of cognitive biases such as overconfidence and unfounded optimism. The useless variability that we call noise is a different type of error. To appreciate the distinction, think of your bathroom scale. We would say that the scale is biased if its readings are generally either too high or too low. If your weight appears to depend on when you happen to place your feet, the scale is noisy. A scale that consistently underestimates true weight by exactly 4 pounds is seriously biased but free of noise. A scale that gives two different readings when you step on it twice is noisy. Many errors or measurements arise from a combination of bias and noise. Most inexpensive bathroom scales are somewhat biased and quite noisy. I think that's an interesting idea of like that these things are different and noise is something else in play that we might think is biased or we might think it's something else.
Right. And when we talk about noise in the book, there were actually a few things on our mind. One is just the glut of information and data and knowledge and just drowning in that what used to be scarce is now abundant in that domain as well. And people like can't even think with all of the stimulus they've got and no longer know how to filter one from the other. But I think the more interesting place where noise comes in, and this kind of gets at a point that is very near and dear to me, which is around reaching shared understanding before action. Shared understanding is blocked by so many things, but especially when you're bringing together a high variety group, you've got specialists from various domains and people who might work in the same organization but have very different jobs who just don't speak the same basic language. And if they're all in a room, again, we use, I think, engineers in the book. If you put a group of engineers in a room, they can say in a word something that would take several paragraphs to explain to somebody who's not an engineer. So when you get a high variety group together, everybody wants to be efficient and speak quickly and get to action as fast as they can. But if they don't slow down and deal with, again, what's called the cost of codification to actually translate what you're saying so that other people can understand it and get on the same page, then the noise is tremendous. People think they hear, they think they understand, they try to understand. They end up coming up with solutions that are, you know, far afield from where they should be because they're based on, you know, mismatched data and expectation and understanding.
You mentioned earlier, too, this sort of checklist approach, but in many ways, this is a checklist, but not a checklist of things to get done, but checklist of ways to get like the path to getting done, which means clearing out a lot of brush. It feels like that's a lot of what this book is like. We're all getting in our own way. We have like our phones ringing are getting in our way. We're talking in a manner that's getting in our way. We have to clear all that out so you can tap into the ideas that you, the good ideas, innovative ideas you already have.
Yeah, that's right. And again, we recognize the conundrum of claiming to have a complicated checklist formula for solving something that's complex. But to me, that's the power of what we're trying to reveal to people and what we're trying to explain to people is that there is an approach, there is a formula, it does work. You can take a step-by-step approach to figuring out things that are not step-by-step in nature.
Yeah.
And you can apply the same formula to, as I, you know, say to people sometimes, it might be doubling the business. It might be figuring out what's next in your personal life. It might be anything if it's got lots of moving parts and needs a creative solution.
I thought it was interesting, too, when we're talking about noise, you mentioned later in the book about some topics that you got to be careful with because they can derail you immediately. And the two of them that you cite are culture and leadership. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Right? So
yes.
Talk to us about why, and I'll see if I can add some color to both of those.
Well, so one of the premises in the agenda, in the formula very quickly, is that you don't go in with an agenda. Once you've got the right group of people involved, you have them look at the very good question you've given them and figure out what they have to talk about. So often, people will want to put culture on the agenda, and they'll think about putting leadership on the agenda and won't be sure.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, culture, I have yet to see an effective conversation which lands on tangible and effective actions to take that are specifically about changing the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because culture is not like that. I always think a culture is something that you see in your peripheral vision, and if you try to look right at it, it disappears on you.
Mm-hmm.
So when you try to get at it by talking about culture, you're not going to get there. So instead, we'll often try to have people, you know, shift their thinking to talking about maybe it's some of the governance structures they've got in place, or how decisions are made, or how accountability is assigned, but something that isn't directly culture for culture's sake. On the leadership side, two things happen that are very interesting. First of all, again, as groups are setting the agenda, they're always a little anxious because they haven't gotten too deep into the formula together yet. So they don't know if they can trust what's going on. They're anxious about calling out that leadership is one of the problems and that we're failing in leadership. So to put that on the agenda means somebody has to be asserting that leadership is a problem.
Yeah.
And we need to talk about it. And they're afraid to. And then even once we have that topic,
mm-hmm.
Often we'll have the leaders in the room, and it won't be until iteration 2 or iteration 3, which is why we need iteration. So second or third time they're talking about it, that people will start to get comfortable and trust that they can actually say what's really going on and call things out that are otherwise left unsaid.
Yeah. All right. So you gave a very elegant response. My less elegant thing is, like, everyone has issues with their boss, and 80% of that is bull. And we fundamentally misunderstand what culture is, because culture is really sort of behaviors that are based on shared values that we don't even talk about, that we just, this is the value system that's in play here. So we know this is how we're supposed to behave. And so that's very hard to sort of, like, you know, legislate inside a boardroom. Culture is hugely important, right? As is good leadership, but it can't get solved in the same way.
That's right. And what I think is very elegant about the formula, and of course I think this, but I've seen it work many, many, many times, is change management and culture, et cetera, which are usually issues and initiatives that are put off until after you've figured out what you have to do. They start, change starts, and culture change starts with the people in the room who've been brought together, with the leaders who have ceded control and are willing to let things go where they're going to go and have embraced emergence, and with people who are stepping up and speaking frankly with each other and taking the time to understand, and so on and so forth. So a lot of what people will say, having applied the formula in their organization, is that we got great solutions, very happy with what we landed with, but what really mattered was that people changed,
yeah.
And some of those changes stuck with those people, and they were able to spread that outside of the time that we spent together and with others who weren't there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. This is a very improv thing you write in the book, which is, quote, "You plan for emergence by expecting it to happen anywhere and at any time. You set up collisions that will drive it to happen. You pay attention to what's happening at the collision points, and you sit and wait." Hard for people to do, but absolutely, those sort of edges is where the good stuff lays.
That's right. And it just takes a different kind of comfort and self-assurance and comfort with the group and belief in the group that something's going to happen, to just sit and wait and not try to force it. And the way we have found to get people there is to almost physically restrain them during a first round of mm-hmm. conversations about things from trying to solve anything. And tell them, no, like, it's not time to solve. Right now it's time to tell stories, express frustrations, get used to each other, and just take on some different kind of behavioral roles than you're used to. Solving is going to come later. And it's so hard for people to do that.
Yeah.
But having done that, right, they're ready later on for things to come.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's the thing about being in the room, and you write about this, which is technology is fantastic, but if we really think we're going to solve complex issues by Skype, I don't think that's going to happen, or certainly not happen easily.
Yeah, we had a whole bunch of other things to say about remote work that we took out of the book because we felt everybody must know this already. But you've got to get in the room. Yeah. We believe in a very vintage human experience,
mm-hmm.
Getting people sitting shoulder to shoulder, smelling each other's breath, hearing the sound of markers on paper and pens on paper, because that's the human experience. And human beings are human beings. And there's a very different dynamic that plays out when you're in the room together.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to, in a second, ask you for your yes and story, which is how we end all the podcasts. It can be something from your work or your life. But before I do that, there was one thing that really kind of caught my attention, which is when you're talking about getting people in the room and diversity of talent, you're also kind of like getting to a number. And this is interesting based on the conversations I had with my behavioral scientist friends, which is what is the optimal number of team members? At what point does innovation break down because there's too many people, and at what point are there too few? And you have some studies you cite around this right number, correct?
Yeah, there's actually a couple of numbers that we absolutely believe in. One is sort of the 7 ±2, so anywhere from 5 to 9 people. That's where good conversations happen. That's where people can actually do some solving. That's where innovation can happen. That's where creativity can happen. And it has something to do with trust,
mm-hmm.
and being able to establish and know that many people. And others, as you start to add to them, we call these collision teams, that particular size. As you start to add to the number of people who are speaking at a given time, you'll start to see people tuning out, and you'll start to see people getting frustrated, et cetera, because there just isn't enough airtime to share with that many people.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're actually dealing with what we call the requisite variety of people, you need to figure out something complex, the number of people that truly represent and can speak to all the different facets of a big challenge, you're up to 30, 40, 50 people, and sometimes more than that. And so what you need to do is get that group together, let them have an experience together, let them do plenaries and group tasks that are doable in that size together. But when it comes time to have deep conversations about important things, you've got to get into sizes of groups that allow for 7 ± to be speaking at a given time.
All right. So what we've discovered at Second City over many, many years is that the ideal cast that develops our shows for our resident stages is 6. We've done it with 5. We've done it with 7. There might have been some more, but our collective experience is 6 is the perfect number in that. So we're right in that range. Classes, we are ideal if we're in the sort of 18 to 22 range for a standard improv class that takes place over 8 weeks, that sort of thing. In the corporate setting, we're in that 30, 40, 50, group where we're like, okay, we could have 2 instructors that can really handle those people. So our numbers do jive in the different expressions. And again, there's not enough research around this particular hallmark of innovation and creativity as it relates to groups in numbers, because to study something sort of with any sort of academic weight, you need, thousands of people. And so you would need to study hundreds and hundreds of small groups, and that just doesn't really exist over a period of time. So that's mm-hmm. why there's such, not rigorous research around these sort of the academic studies around effective innovation in small groups.
Yeah, and certainly I believe there is no accident whatsoever to the fact that we've found the same numbers or similar numbers.
Yeah. Well, because the other thing we're both doing is we got there because we experimented for so long. I mean, this is the amazing thing about working at Second City is recognizing, you've done all this experimenting and communication in front of audiences over a long period of time to get to these insights. And you've done the same thing with your clients. And one of the things, one of the things I like about the book is you're not saying like this is Six Sigma. But you're saying there's a number of different processes that we can draw on and get insights from. We're basically saying this is the way we think you can tackle your problem, despite whether you're an airline or a theater company or, you know, a non-for-profit dealing with hunger, that it's really about human behavior and the understanding of how we best work.
Right. And I think one of the points we really tried to make at the beginning of the book is that this formula is not something that we dreamt up. We've certainly assembled the pieces in a particular way, and we do things in a particular way, and we're explaining the formula in a new way. But there's a lot of wisdom of the ages baked into every step of the process. And I'm a math and computer science person by background. Mm-hmm. I love the elegance of things that are simple and yet work, or as simple as possible. And so, again, we've just taken a lot of wisdom that's out there and pulled it across the finish line, as we say in the book, into something that just works and we've observed working, and leaders constantly tell us just works for them.
All right. So now my yes and question for you, which feels like a softball because you read the book and knowing what your life's work is. But I'm wondering if you do. Do you have a story about a time in your life when you normally would have said no, but instead you said yes and?
Well, I already knew what I wanted to talk about, having been prompted to think about this.
Yeah.
And then I finished your book and I saw the comment that you had yes anded your book, and I smiled because we yes anded our book.
Yeah.
We knew we couldn't write a book about the formula without applying the formula to the book. But what was interesting is we decided that we would hold off. We initially had a little bit of fear about doing that too soon in the process and getting in the way of what we had to do in terms of dumping our thoughts. So what we did is we accelerated our manuscript deadline. We got it done 6 weeks earlier than we needed to. Mm-hmm. We then invited a requisite variety group of people who had worked on the book, people on our staff, customers, believers, people who had worked with cyberneticians in the 70s on some of the concepts in the book. And we had them take the book apart. And where it became yes and, mm-hmm, is we went in with a lot of fear about what we would get because we only had 6 weeks till deadline.
Yeah.
And we tried to constrain the group. We tried to say, no, we just want stylistic comments and a few things that we can do to make it better. Mm-hmm. And of course, what the group did, because the formula works, is they pulled the book apart. Mm-hmm. They said the structure is wrong. They said you're not telling the stories well enough. And we needed to melt away from the no but and embrace the yes and. And if I showed you a copy of the book pre and post, you'd see just how much of a rewrite we did in the 6 weeks, minus the 2 weeks I was scheduled to be in Italy that we had until deadline.
That's
great. So yeah, it was a great experience, and I would do that on any other book I write in the future.
Yeah, except you're going to give yourself more than 6 weeks because that's an insane time to rewrite a book.
But it was all just there. It was amazing, and it was only there because we threw away the fear of the no but, and we said, okay, let's go for it. Let's hear it all.
The book is called Cracking Complexity, the Breakthrough Formula for Solving Just About Anything Fast. David Benjamin, thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.